This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We last spoke with Peter Bick following the release of his documentary film Carbon Nation. He billed it as a climate change solutions movie that doesn't even care if you believe in climate change. Indeed, many of the people he spoke with in his film were taking steps to positively change the way they used energy, not because they believed in climate change. They were doing so because it made economic sense. And yet, even in the face of the climate change that is becoming clear even to non-scientists, some find changing their relationship to energy difficult. On the other hand, some unlikely companies are altering the way they interface with energy. Even a major oil company has begun to promote energy conservation. Here in the middle of what Mayor Kinsey has declared Environmental Sustainability Week in Charlotte, the U.S. Green Building Council, North Carolina, has brought Peter Bick to town to speak after a screening of his film today. And we invited him to join us in advance to give us an update on the story that has been called the most important story of our time and possibly the past few thousand years. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Good to see you again.
Yep.
We're also going to bring in a local advocate of doing what's right for the environment and for yourself by saving money in the process. Terry Bennett, founder and president of Do Your Part, which is a book, a website, and far more than that. Welcome back. Good to see you again as well.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm great. You became interested in climate change, Peter, in 2006. When did you become interested in all that? I know you've been a meteorologist for a long time, but when did you
become? Gosh. Well, I started in meteorology and
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So it was a long time ago. Shall we say the late 80s, early 90s?
And was climate change being discussed then?
No, that would have been in the education environment. But once we moved into the television environment, you know, it certainly was something that we were always being educated on with continuing education. But in my days in television, we were not allowed to mention global warming on the set or in the newscast because it is so incredibly polarizing.
Mm-hmm.
But every time we walked into a room, it was the first question: how do you feel about global warming? What's happening? So it's a very conversation.
I used to have daily conversations on the radio with a meteorologist from a major forecasting company, the largest privately owned forecasting company in the world. They would go unnamed, and Dr. Sobel used to say, "I don't believe in it. It's not true. It's not happening." But in 2006, I think some scientists, maybe many scientists, had come to the conclusion. And this morning in the paper, both the New York Times, USA Today, and The Observer, there's a story about how 95% of scientists today say global warming is not only a reality, but we're causing it. And 95% doesn't sound like 100%, but it's as close to 100% as scientists will go on most anything except the existence of gravity.
Yeah. Well, Maggie Thatcher, in a speech to the UN in 1989, she was a chemist, which I didn't know until I read her speech, and she mentioned that she was a chemist. And she said, "Listen, I'm a politician and I'm a chemist and a scientist. And if you get us to agree over 50% on anything, that's a remarkable thing." And at the time, it was in the 70s, 70% of scientists were saying humans were causing climate change back then. It's, you know, the issue, the reason that it became politicized is it's just a well-laid-out plan that worked really well. The well's been poisoned on people doubting whether climate change is happening or not. So now what do you do with a poisoned well? There's so many other benefits to going down the road towards clean energy and energy efficiency that's the point that we're pushing right now, because it just makes sense. It makes sense.
But the debate about this continues to go on, and people refuse to believe that scientists, almost to a person, say it's happening and we're causing it. They simply refuse to believe it. So in your film, Carbon Nation, you decided to take a different tact, and you've decided to take this different tact in many different avenues, and that is ignore the argument. Don't have the argument.
Yeah. Yeah, because you're wasting time. Because the fact that you're having the argument is a beautifully laid out plan that's decades old, that's working really well.
And when you say it's a beautifully laid out plan, are you saying that the deniers of climate change have planned out the argument to win? Or are they planning out the argument to win because not only do they deny it, they may believe in it, but they don't care. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think if you look at Naomi Oreskes' book, Merchants of Doubt, the folks that have planted all the seeds about whether climate change is real or is it happening or humans causing it followed the tobacco industry's game plan to a T.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just being able to say the science isn't conclusive, there's doubt.
But, you know, the heads of tobacco companies could have sold their product till the cows came home. As long as they didn't smoke it, they or their children, they were going to live, even though they knew that cigarettes caused cancer.
Right.
We all live on the planet.
And I know, that is the strange thing. But if you can sell your product for as long as possible, right? So, you know, if you're selling a high carbon intense product and you don't want it regulated, then you're gonna want people to not think that climate change is real for a long time. Now, a lot of folks who were planting those seeds in the 90s and the 80s and the early part of the century are all saying, hey, no, we know it's real. You know, all the oil companies now pretty much say it's real, except for, I think, Exxon's Rex Tillerman. Mm-hmm. He's not saying it's human caused. But again, what are the issues? What can we do to push the ball forward? And really, for me, I'm looking at carbon in the air. I believe we have too much carbon in the air, so how do you get it down? And one of the most amazing things that I'm learning about right now and that I'm studying is how we ranch and how we farm is a huge way of getting carbon back in the soil. And actually, a lot of the carbon in the air right now, some people are saying half the carbon in the air right now that humans have put up there is from the soil over the last 200 years from plowing and poor grazing and poor farming. So what happens is when you start getting your soils healthy again, you get the carbon back in the soil, you actually affect the water cycle. So that what happened in Colorado with all that water running off doesn't happen as much when you have healthy soil because it gets absorbed into the soil. So there's a whole lot of things going on right now with soil that I'm focused on.
So it isn't the evil oil companies, it's the evil farmers who are responsible for
it. No, it's not. I don't think it's evil anybody. I mean, I flew here. I use oil. I don't know how you got here.
Yeah.
I don't know if you use oil. I don't think anything's necessarily evil. I just think there's got to be better ways to do it. And so I'm thinking that there's got to be solutions with the oil companies as opposed to against the oil companies.
And we're going to talk about those, but I want to get back to the argument. I know that you say that the argument, having the argument wastes time, and the other side, the people who deny climate change, want us to have this argument because as long as we're talking about it, we aren't doing anything.
Correct.
About it. But I want to talk to Terry here for a second because she's a meteorologist and she follows weather patterns in addition to being an environmentalist. We've had extraordinary, I think, you tell me, weather this summer just in the United States. It's happened all over the world, but we don't follow the rest of the world. We've had the terrible fires in the West. We've had the terrible flooding in Colorado. We had incredible amounts of rain here through much of the summer. Some of these storms have been characterized as once-in-a-century storms, but they're all happening at the same time, and they're likely to happen again next year, right?
Oh, I don't know that you can conclusively really make that statement. I mean, weather does move in cycles, and certainly it has been a very active year. And as we do see climate warming and changing, the anticipation is that the rainy storms will produce more rain and the droughts will be more severe. And we are seeing some of that come to fruition. And the fact that it has all occurred this summer, you know, I love to say that, well, didn't your grandpa say that I went to school uphill 3 miles and 3 feet of snow?
Both ways.
If you go back and you look at history, I mean, the Big Thompson flood back in the 70s and the same place that has flooded again now in Colorado, it has happened before. Certainly, we are much more in tune to the fact that it's happening, and there's so much media coverage over it. But you can't say with any degree of certainty that you can expect more of this next year.
You're not helping the argument then. And then on the other...
You know, and I wanted to go back to when you were talking to Peter, because here's a statement that I make when I go out to public, and Peter and I are on the same page. Get over the argument, get over the politics, and move on with what's really important. Because don't you find it extremely naive to believe that we as humans can just put whatever we want into the air, land, and water and have no impact? Isn't that slightly naive to believe?
Well, it would be go against the law of science. What goes up must come down.
True.
It's kind of the same thing. There's a reaction to every action.
Absolutely.
But to your point about weather patterns, you're the professional. I'm just learning stuff. But what's happening is with the higher temperatures, what I'm understanding is the jet stream's actually slowing down. And instead of doing a sort of a straighter pattern across the U.S. or a slight S-curve, it's now doing these big loopy curves. And when it does those big loopy curves, you get these breaks where weather patterns don't move, which is what happened with Sandy, and it's what happened with the rains in Colorado. And I was in Louisville in summer of 2009. We had 6 inches in an hour. And these breaks are happening. It seems like those breaks are happening more, and that fits the models for the climate models. But it's incredibly complicated.
So that when it rains, it just keeps raining because the weather system can't move out, although people will then point to the fact that it's been a very mild hurricane season.
Exactly. So there are trade-offs on both sides.
Okay. And other people point out that we've seen a plateauing of rising temperatures. Mm-hmm. They haven't risen as much as they have in the last several years. But scientists now believe that that may be because of some of the weather systems that have converged, but also because a lot of the heat in the atmosphere is now penetrating into the deep oceans.
True.
That's true. What are the implications of that?
Well, you know, and then you start talking about ice melt and glaciers melting and the corresponding sea level rise. In my opinion, the sea level rising is one of the biggest problems we face with climate change, because something like, Peter, and you can probably correct me on this, 30% of the or 80% of the world's population lives within 30 miles of a coastline. I mean, it's some astronomical number. And as that water begins to rise, that is definitely going to change the way we survive on this planet.
And it's not just as though the water will come over the Battery in Charleston. It'll creep up the estuary. Salt water will go up
Absolutely.
Into the rivers. And you'll lose land mass, but you'll also change the character of the water supply.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The freshwater piece is really important.
Yeah.
What you've got like in Florida with the Everglades or with the Sacramento Delta in California, that's a big piece. But at the same time, there's solutions. I'm just going to keep pushing solutions because it's just where my brain is. In the Sacramento Delta, it's been sinking because they've been farming the peat, basically, all the wetlands. And so as the U.S. Geological Survey is working on building up the peat, and when they build up the peat, that holds an enormous amount of carbon, but it's also keeping the salt water away from getting into the Sacramento Delta, which basically feeds water to most of California. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, how do you economically take land from farming and put it back into peat production and build up the wetlands? Those are the questions right now. It's like, where's the economic driver for that? But we know that how much would it cost if you lost all the water for California? That's going to cost – I don't think you can put a price on it.
Right.
So these are all the issues right now, is where do you put the economic drivers to help push these things forward?
So in your film Carbon Nation, which we talked extensively about last time and which you're screening today at 1230 at UNC Charlotte
And I'll be there too for
okay,
the Q&A
okay.
afterwards.
You're not preaching these messages. You are talking to real people in this film who some of them do not believe in climate change and certainly don't believe that we have anything to do with it. And yet they are coming up with solutions that are either saving them money or making them money. What kind of impact has this film had as you screened it around the country?
I think the strongest impact the film's having is with students. A perfect example, I was just told that this very, very brilliant young woman in high school who was going to go into finance saw the film and decided she's going to go into solar energy. She's going to put her brain into that technology rather than derivatives and making quick bucks.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get those stories over and over and over again. That, to me, is the impact that I'm seeing that I'm really excited about. There's been screenings that I just don't know about that people are having in churches and schools all over the
country. We're going to come back and talk more about solutions to this problem and solutions that may save you money on a large scale and at home on a smaller scale when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Providence Day School, inviting families to an admissions open house Tuesday, October 1st at 6 p.m. for grades transitional kindergarten and kindergarten. Information at providenceday.org. And Signature Healthcare, celebrating 10 years of offering concierge medical care, providing patients with 24/7 physician access, personalized executive healthcare, and same-day appointments. SignatureHealthcare.com. Well, in the world of sports, we are on the map with the NFL, the NBA, and soon the Charlotte Knights will be playing uptown. And these clubs, of course, bring excitement and exposure. But there is a cost. What is that cost? Well, professional teams regularly ask for and receive all kinds of concessions and monetary perks. We're going to look at the relationship between sports teams and the cities in which they play tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama and Iran's President Rouhani separately address the UN General Assembly, high-level meetings, and the prospects for improved relations with Iran.
Join us for 2 hours of the Diane Rehm Show this morning and every weekday morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on 90.7 WFAE. We are listener-supported public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about climate change and solutions for climate change with Peter Bick, who's a producer and director and also the producer and director of a film called Carbon Nation, which will be screened at 12:30 today at UNC Charlotte's Uptown campus. Peter Bick will be there. You can ask questions about the film, and it is open to the public. You can find information about that on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalk. He's also a professor of practice, at Arizona State University, which means because you have in the communications department, because you know how to produce a film, they let you teach?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. That's been really fun. I just got an email from one of my students that she might have erased her footage from her interviews last week, so I'm a little concerned about that.
That happened. That's a terrible thing. Well, it's a good lesson to learn. He's at the School of Sustainability at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communications. Also with us, Terry Bennett, a meteorologist and founder and president of Do Your Part. In North Carolina, there was a proposal. I'm not sure where that proposal stands, but it was a proposal to ban the use of LEED standards in the construction of new public buildings. And LEED is a explain LEED to me.
It's a grading system from the USGBC, the U.S. Green Building Council, where it's basically they give you points for everything in your building that creates a situation where you're saving energy and or doing things more efficiently and or using materials that are more local, because then it doesn't travel as much, therefore it's a lower carbon footprint. They give you points for putting a shower in your building, a bike rack, good lighting, lots of windows, fresh air, all these pieces get put into the grading system.
So, of course, it makes sense, and so there's a proposal to ban that in North Carolina, and the legislature has effectively made it illegal to use climate change forecasts concerning sea level to set policy. We can look back to historical records, but we cannot look forward to what climate scientists are saying will happen if things don't change. This seems like almost willfully – this seems like willful ignorance.
Yeah, that one is a head-scratcher, because – do you want to do a lot of developing along your coast and then have it get washed away? I mean, I would ask – okay, so maybe that's the state legislature making their call there, but what are the insurance companies doing? Because that's going to tell you where the dollars are. And are the insurance companies insuring things that are being built along the coast, or are they saying stop building along the coasts? Mm-hmm. And so follow the money. And I think a lot of insurance companies are waking up to the fact that there's enormous risk for coastline development, so they're going to say no.
And where a great deal of this country's money goes is into national defense. And the Department of Defense recognizes climate change as a fact.
Absolutely.
Are not only planning for it, they're changing policies and procedures to take that into account, because they call this a national security issue.
Yeah, and let me just take it down to a very personal level. I've met a lot of veterans of the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, and many of them are coming home and getting into clean energy businesses because they know they've been fighting a resource war. And so that to me says an enormous amount. Mm-hmm. Delivering oil to the front lines is where most of the 20% of the injuries in those wars were people bringing fuel to the front lines.
So now and the enemy knew that these fuel convoys were coming through, and they targeted
them. It's an easy target.
Yeah.
And so then the forward operating bases, the Army and the Marines and the Navy and everybody were saying, hey, why don't we just not use fuel on the front lines? Let's make it much more energy efficient. Or, hey, how about if we just use solar on the front lines? So there's a story of a grenade launcher smacking into a solar panel. Instead of hitting a diesel generator and blowing shrapnel on everybody around, it just put a hole in the solar panel, and the rest of the solar panel kept making electrons. And so those are technologies that we're going to get here. Everything that they push there, it's our tax dollars, and they're bringing things back, smaller, more efficient batteries, much more efficient solar.
And you, I think it's you who tells the story of a military base. I've forgotten where it was now, but there was an electric line that ran from the generation station to the base that was about 18 miles long.
Yep.
And there had to be some maintenance done, and they called the military base and said, we have to shut your power off for X number of hours so that we can do this maintenance. And the head of the base then
said, that's ridiculous. And realized how vulnerable Fort Irwin was, and that was where every soldier in the Army went to go get trained for deployment in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so General Petard just said, you know what, this is ridiculous. So he started pushing clean energy initiatives on his base. He then went to Fort Bliss and started pushing it there as well. He's since retired, which makes me sad. But there's a huge solar development with that utility on Fort Irwin that's under development right now. And you just have all this land that's already degraded. You know, why take good farmland to make a solar project? But you've got a lot of degraded land. You can put solar out there, and
So two questions about that. If the military gets it, that must be a good sign, and that will filter out of the military and into other areas.
But it already
if the military
has.
Gets it, why don't politicians get it?
That's a good question. I don't understand Washington on this. But when I'm out in the country – and I'm talking to all sorts of people, skeptics, whatever. They get it. And if they don't say, hey, climate change is real and humans are causing it, they still like clean air and clean water. And Americans want solar power in huge numbers. It's like 90% that Americans want solar power. And Americans will pay more money for wind, according to Google's research, at 70%. 70% of Americans want wind and will pay more money for it. Mm-hmm. So these are huge, huge numbers in the American.
But then you hear about the projects, wind projects, like mm-hmm. the ones that were proposed off the coast of mm-hmm. North Carolina, and there are people who are against that because it's going to spoil their view of the horizon. I guess I don't know. I mean, yeah. But they'll barely be able to see, if at all,
yeah.
the wind turbines. But they're afraid that will spoil their view. I mean, that just seems.
I disagree with that aesthetic.
I think they're beautiful.
I think they're
I
beautiful.
Do too.
I like the way they look. I also like what they're doing. And I would also question how many people have protested power lines going to coal plants versus how many people have protested power lines coming from solar fields.
Yeah.
And so it's things are being held up at different standards right now. But, you know, the wind developer has to do a better job of telling the story and get their project sold. Because it's doing amazing stuff. I mean, they got offshore wind in England that's just kicking butt.
One of the problems that you say that we've had with this conversation about climate change is where it's coming from and how it's being positioned. It's coming usually from the left. It's coming from tree huggers and Birkenstock wearing NPR listeners.
What are you wearing right now?
Birkenstocks. and from scientists who don't address the economics. They address the science, mm-hmm. but not the economics. And as we all know, the rubber meets the road where your pocketbook is affected. Is that what you're trying to do? And I know that's what you're trying to do, Terry. Is that what you're trying to do, Peter?
Oh, there's no question. And when you talk about the economics of different fuels, like what does that electron really cost when it's from coal? What's it cost from solar? What's it cost from natural gas? All those things just need to be equalized so everyone knows, you know, what everything costs. And there's a lot of costs to coal specifically that we don't pay. I don't pay on my utility bill. When I was living in Kentucky, we were 93% coal, our electrons. And there's a lot of costs to nature. You know, when you take down a mountain, you're taking down the ability of the mountain to clean water, you know, and all the streams that are now lost. So when the water gets to a city, it's a lot dirtier. So you have to put on the water treatment plant for longer and you have to use more energy. That just costs money mm-hmm. to clean that water more when
right.
the mountain did it before. And those costs, you know, healthcare costs with clean air and not clean air and all those things factored in the United States, if you just look at the external costs of using coal, it's about $1/3 trillion a year that we're all paying. It's just not in any bill. Mm-hmm. So we're not seeing it, but we're all paying it. So that's, to me, the carbon tax that we're already paying. I would propose let's lower that carbon tax by using cleaner energy. In a higher percentage.
You, Terry, have been talking about this first as a meteorologist. Although you couldn't talk about it on the air, as you said, when you walk into a room, you go out to speak, that's what they wanted to know about. They
sure.
wanted to know about climate change. And now as the owner and operator of this company called Do Your Part, which is about cleaner living, environmentally friendly living. It's also about how you can save money living that way. What kind of reaction do you get from people?
Well, you know, I've had people say to me, well, I don't recycle because I don't believe in climate change. And, you know, that's just such a silly statement in my book. But overwhelmingly, when you start talking about, you know, even in my book, I say, when I speak, let's talk about climate change, let's talk about the arguments on both sides, and then let's put that over here. Because what I want to talk about is creating healthier homes, healthier families, mm-hmm. that also is better for the planet, and generally in the long run will save you money. Perfect example, going back to your previous conversation, are the compact fluorescent light bulbs. You know, yes, they may lower the amount of electrons that you need to come to your home, but the thing I preach continually is complete the loop. Where did they come from? Where were they made? How did they get here? What's inside of them? How are we going to recycle them? Sure, you saved a few pennies on your electric bill, but what were the overall cost associated with this? And frankly, we're now measuring tons of mercury coming over from China that's airborne because pollution knows no boundaries. So sure, we saved a little bit on our energy bills, but now we have escalated amounts of mercury in the
air. So we should avoid those and what, by LEDs?
LED really is a future of lighting, and it's really come a long way over the last couple of years. And like any other new technology, prices will come down. I mean, there was a time when DVRs cost several hundred dollars, and now you can pick one up for $50.
Right.
Same thing will happen with LEDs.
But the LEDs last, for people who, I've bought a few.
I recently bought one, and it was not a cheap bulb.
No,
well, no. Well, no, this one was shaped like an incandescent, and it was one of the newer models, and it had, and I wanted to take it, and we did a story on it, and we put it side by side with incandescents. We compared the light, the heat, and it's forecast to last 22 years. So think about it. You could have a baby and put a light bulb in their nursery.
Right.
And send them off to college with the same light bulb.
And I think a 60-watt light bulb, a 60-watt, an LED that generates what is the equivalent to 60 watts of incandescent light is like, what, 9 watts? So you...
It's very efficient and doesn't put off the heat.
Are these the kinds of things that are being done on a larger scale with some of the people that you talked to for this movie and some of the people that you've since talked to since you put this movie out?
Well, the CFL thing, just real quick... The mercury coming from China is from coal burning.
I know. There's a great amount of that.
So you got. I think we all have to be careful about alarmist kind of discussions and things like that.
But then there is the mercury in the bulbs.
Yeah,
so
but
you
if
can't
we
just throw it in the trash.
But using CFLs lowers the amount of energy you use, right? And using less coal energy lowers the mercury by quite a bit. You would have to break open every single CFL that's sold in the United States to get enough mercury in the air to equal how much energy you're saving that would be going in the air anyway if you're burning coal with an incandescent light. So you would have to be – you would literally have – the mercury being saved by not burning coal, by having more energy-efficient lighting is by far greater than the mercury that would be emitted by the CFLs.
So you're in favor of them.
Sure, absolutely. And I'd love LEDs. I think LEDs is a natural step. But I don't want people to be scared of these light bulbs, you know, because it's not the worst thing in the world by any
stretch. And
it's
not the mercury in the bulb I think they should be afraid of. It's that the fact that they are produced in China where the coal naturally contains higher levels of mercury. There's very little environmental control. So the mercury is exposed to the workers, to the environment. And just because it's in China, it still ends up here. So it's really more about the production of the CFLs than it is the mercury inside.
But you're talking about the production of everything.
Well, sure.
Every cell phone, every these headphones, everything. So we just moved all of our pollution creation over to China.
Absolutely.
And it blows back over the ocean. Absolutely. That's a whole different ballgame.
But if we produce some of these products here, if we produce them here, they would be more strictly controlled, environmentally speaking, than they are over there.
And it would be too expensive, so we won't do that.
Right.
Well, there is a lot of manufacturing that's coming over here, but it's the higher-end manufacturing. But back to personal stories and saving money and things like that. Mm-hmm. The last time I was here, I went off to another town in North Carolina, and I interviewed a woman who ran a nursing home, an assisted living place. And she was being talked to about getting a new basically making their place much more energy efficient. And she had an old boiler, and she just thought that it was just too good to be true. The numbers that were being given to her, the amount of time it would take to pay back that investment was too quick. But she did it, and she's saving enormous amounts of money, and the heating bill is a lot lower. The quality of their mm-hmm. of their electricity, the quality of their air conditioning is a lot better. So it's just a simple story of if you spend the money and you can do something that takes 10 years for the return of investment or 5 years, that it just makes everything better and you're saving enormous amounts of money. Just those sort of stories are the ones that really are where the rubber meets the road. It's these energy efficiency stories are where there's so much opportunity. And the studies are showing that we waste 50% of the energy coming into our buildings.
Is part of the problem here, because you talk to a lot of people who are doing some very interesting things, from farmers to people up in Alaska. I'm not sure what he was doing. I can't remember
It was low-temperature geothermal power.
Okay. Who are doing a lot of interesting things that do save money and do not harm the environment. But the upfront costs
that's a big deal.
Are enormous.
Yeah.
On a smaller scale, a good example would be these LED lights. Yeah, if I could afford to replace every light bulb in my house with an LED light, I would do it tomorrow because I would save money on my electric bill. But at $30 a bulb, that's not going to happen. So how do we get beyond these upfront costs?
Yeah, when you have a school or a hospital, these things that are going to be there for a while, these upfront costs can easily be factored in. And it's just a question of policy, really. And the banks are starting to loan with that in mind. They're starting to understand this is a smart loan, because if you're thinking ahead with an energy efficient system, then you're going to pay your bills, you're going to pay your loan, because you're actually thinking ahead. And it goes all the way through the stock market. When companies are making these decisions to be transparent about what they use and that they're showing that they're pushing and pushing and pushing to get more energy efficiency out of their company, their stocks are going up, and the rate that they're paying interest is going down. So it actually makes sense on a lot of levels to be doing energy efficiency, because it's good business, and that upfront cost is the biggest hurdle. Mm-hmm. And so if we can get out of the mindset of quarterly reports, right, and get the person in a company who's paying the electric bill to be also responsible for the equipment being purchased. Those are the sorts of things that are happening right now in the military, where they're putting those people together so that you have responsibility for life cycle assessment of that piece, which is what you were talking about, life cycle assessment.
Right, big time.
So the life cycle assessment, it might be the more expensive generator at the beginning, but you'll pay it back, and then you'll start making lots more money. And people are starting to really understand that. I mean, companies are getting this. The most exciting story I've got right now is with Microsoft. They have an internal carbon tax. They call it an internal carbon fee. It's about a year old, where they're charging a tax on carbon internally to any department, and then taking that money and using it to either buy like really cool carbon offset projects that are verifiable, like methane reclamation projects around the world, or they're using it to push energy efficiencies in other departments.
Why are they doing that?
Because they're proving that it's actually saving them money. By putting a price on carbon in the company, they're proving that it's actually lowering their costs, because people are then becoming so much more aware of their energy use that they're lowering their energy bills.
Is it lowering my cost when I buy a Surface tablet?
That's a good question. I'll have to ask him that.
All right. Please do it. Do it now. Peter Bick, who's the director of Carbon Nation. Terry Bennett with us also, founder and president of Do Your Part, which concerns itself with environmentally friendly things you can do around the house. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Invisible Fence Brand, committed to keeping pets safe at home with customized pet protection solutions now for any sized property, from zero lot lines to large acreage. Details at InvisibleFence.com. And Southeast Anesthesiology Consultants, partnering with healthcare professionals and physicians in Charlotte and the surrounding area for over 30 years, dedicated to assuring safety and administering comfort. SEAnesthesiology.com. President Obama and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani separately addressed the United Nations General Assembly, a look at high-level meetings and the prospect for improved relations with Iran, the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. And our guest today, Peter Bick's film Carbon Nation, is being screened later today at 12:45 at the Uptown campus of UNC Charlotte. You can get details about that on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks, where you can also contact us.
Big day at the job. Make it break time. They're all waiting for you right now in the conference room. Well, they're going to have to wait.
because you're not leaving the radio until you hear the end of that story. Snap Judgment from NPR. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it. Saturdays at 8 p.m. or Fridays at 10 p.m. on WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Peter Bick, the producer and director of Carbon Nation, which will be screened today at 12:30 at UNC Charlotte's Uptown Campus. WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks has more information about that. Terry Bennett is also with us, founder and president of Do Your Part. One of the things that you like to talk about, obviously, because we've talked about it a lot on this program so far, and you spend the entire movie talking about this, and that is solutions to all of this. Don't get bogged down in the argument over climate change. Talk about solutions, not only solutions that save you money, but solutions that will make life better.
Or safer.
Okay. And one of the things, you know, we love beef in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked a little bit about soil a few minutes ago, but this lends itself to that conversation as well. The way we grow and feed cattle for beef production is by feeding them corn. And if we fed them grass, what would change?
Well, we start all cattle off on grass. And then a lot of cows are taken to feedlots, and we're feeding them grain. I just interviewed a farmer in Bismarck, North Dakota. His name is Gabe Brown, and he is a grass-finished beef grower. And he says that he has slaughtered a lot of cattle over his decades of doing the work he does, and he's never seen a gizzard in any cow that he's slaughtered. And you need a gizzard to digest grain. That's basically the bottom line. And so corn for cattle is not healthy. They're not made to eat it. They're made to eat grass. They evolved with the grasses. So what Gabe does, and a lot of other ranchers that I'm interviewing, is they basically take their herds of cattle and they move them as if they were herds of bison being hunted by wolves. So they'll be on one piece of land for a short period of time, impact it big time, hooves into the soil, pooing, all the other stuff. And then he moves him off that land into another paddock on his farm, and he breaks his ranch down into many, many paddocks. And so he lets that land rest, and he'll let it rest for 60 days or 80 days before the cattle come back on. And what it's doing is it's rejuvenating his prairie land. It's bringing back all the native plants. There's a seed bank in his soil that's just been dormant.
Mm-hmm.
Because the way we have been doing cattle is not the way nature and the way these animals and the grasslands evolved. So we're taking it and we're changing it. And
because when it was open plain,
yeah,
cattle would eat everything in sight, and when there was nothing left, they'd move on.
Right, but if they're eating everything in sight, yet they're in a fenced-in area, even though it's a large area, mm-hmm, they're not moving in any sort of way that's helping the land.
Okay.
And so we've taken the predators out. If they knew there was predators, they would be herding together, and they would be moving in a natural way that would constantly be – they wouldn't be coming back if there was a wolf there. They know not to come back there for a long time. And so what these ranchers are getting is they're getting their soils turned back on, and it's an amazing process. They're getting so much more water retention on their land. They're getting so much more nutrients in their grasses. They're getting so much more forage, so much more grass. And so this giant cost of raising cattle is to feed them. Well, they're feeding them from the land, and they don't have any inorganic inputs. They're not putting any fertilizers into their land, because the way they keep the land covered in soil, covered in plants, they're getting all the nutrients, like nitrogen. Inorganic nitrogen fertilizer is very expensive. But if you plant a legume on your soil, you're pulling down nitrogen from the air, which is nitrogen's the most plentiful thing in what we're breathing. And you don't need to put that fertilizer in. So they're saving money. They're making a lot more money.
And are the cows healthier?
The cows are healthier. When you have grass-finished beef, it's actually a health food.
Mm-hmm.
It's got as much omega-3 as salmon, and it's very low in omega-6. When you have grain-finished animals, you have a lot of omega-6 in the beef and a lot less omega-3. And then you have all the hormones that they're feeding. Maybe not even hormones, but all the antibiotics that they're feeding them.
Mm-hmm. So everybody wins.
Everybody wins unless you're selling the feedlot system. You're not winning in there, right? So if you're selling corn for animals,
right,
you're not winning. But everyone knows that we have enough people to eat the corn on Earth right now. We don't
yes
need to be feeding it to the animals.
And we make gasoline or ethanol out of corn.
Which,
so there's lots of uses for corn.
There's lots of uses for corn. But what these ranchers, they're making – and then they're stacking enterprises. So after the cattle have been on there and done their thing, mm-hmm. Gabe's son Paul is taking in his free-range chickens and putting them out there. And then they're doing their thing with all the eating and the pooing and all that stuff. And it's all just nutrients, nutrients, nutrients.
And as you point out, none of this takes any new technology.
Right. It's new planning.
It's completely untechnological. It's the way things used to be.
Right. But it's new thinking. And it's also we're doing lots of measurement now that didn't exist before. And the soil scientists, the smart ones 10 years ago said they knew 10% of what was in the soil. Now the smart ones say they know 1% of what's in the soil. They're calling it the biome. There's this world of stuff in the soil that we have virtually no idea about, yet it's what feeds us. And we have a biome. We're being told that 90% of us, 90% of what's inside our bodies is not us. It's a different DNA. It's a different things. And so is it the biome in the soil that's feeding the biome in the cow gut? Because the cows don't digest the grass. The biome in their gut digests the grass. And so it's this whole new thing of what are we feeding? What is it? And it's like a brave new world.
Yeah. A lot of this sounds on a larger, different kind of scale, like some of the things that you've been preaching on your website, doyourpart.com, and in your book about non-technological ways to make your life better, to save money, to do things that don't hurt. Some examples of things that are like that, but on a smaller scale in the house.
Well, I think rain barrels are a perfect example. I mean, growing up, my grandmother always was collecting rain and finding ways to reuse it. And then we've really got away from that. And it's such an easy solution to capturing water that your plants prefer. It's free. And anyone who contends that, you know, you're going to just create a breeding ground for mosquitoes really doesn't understand how to do it properly, because there are certainly ways to prevent that from happening. You know, there's, you know, using worms as compost. Right here at our own airport, they have recently started a new recycling program, and I spoke with Bob Lucas yesterday, and they just recently invested in 150,000 pounds of worms. And they are composting all the food waste coming out of the airport. And every day at Charlotte Douglas, where roughly 120,000 people come through every day, we generate 20 to 25 tons of trash.
Wow.
Every day. So they are embarking on a new recycling program, and even after just 1 year are already recovering 50% of the waste that is created at the airport. And they didn't do it because they woke up one day and said, well, this is the right thing to do. They did it because they were spending so much money in landfill fees.
Yep.
And is that one of the ways you get, without making the argument that we're causing climate change and if we don't do something now, we're doomed. Without making that argument, mm-hmm. you remove the urgency from the equation. So when you remove the urgency from the equation, people go, well, I'll get around to it. It makes sense, but I'll get around to it. So, we never get around to it. Is that one of the ways that we can prove that getting around to it makes sense?
You know, what I find is when you talk to people and you say, this is a healthier way of living, you know, the air inside your home is dirtier than the air outside your home. Let me help you clean it up so you can have healthier, happier families. Overwhelmingly, I get very little rejection. I find very few people who say, yeah, we don't want a healthier home. Mm-hmm. I mean, that just doesn't really come up. Yeah. So that's how I combat the argument is, you know, forget about how you feel about this. Uh-huh. And I'm a big advocate of the eco footprint, where everything you do has an impact on the planet, not just the carbon conversation. So if you do these things, you clean up your act, you have lower health care costs, you have healthier children, your kids don't have asthma, allergies. I mean, I have tons of stories of moms who have cleaned up their act at home and changed the life of their children who were ill.
Wow.
Yeah, and there's a study that I was told about at Columbia University has a hospital up, you know, up in 125th Street in New York. And they were doing – so they're using technology, right? And they're seeing who's coming into the emergency room, what kind of events, a lot of asthma events. And then they start marking exactly where those patients live. Mm-hmm. And they found one hot spot building.
Wow.
That isn't that amazing?
Producing an enormous amount of asthma patients. So they went and they figured out how much the emergency room's visits were costing them and how much it would cost to renovate that building, which was cheaper, a lot cheaper, for the hospital. So the hospital renovated that building to save money for itself.
Unbelievable. Well, let's talk about oil, because that is the carbon problem. And your film is called Carbon Nation. And I'm sure there are a lot of oil companies who have been doing this battle saying we're not responsible for this, and everybody knows we are a car society in America. It would be relatively impossible to live a modern life without it would be impossible to live a modern life without oil. You say that oil should not be pointed to as the Satan in this equation, and that big oil companies are now beginning to recognize this problem, and they're promoting in some cases cutting edge ideas and technology. When oil companies see the light, what does that say?
Well, it says that there's an issue, right? Now, I'm not going to say that oil companies have seen the light.
not going quite that far.
what I'm working on is getting back to, I'm looking at how the systems work and where do the systems intersect and where's the benefit intersect. So when you've got this situation with ranching and farming, mm-hmm. where you're increasing the carbon in the soil, it's looking like huge amounts. And the data is really new. And so there's a place where data collection is really needed. But what we're seeing in the data that we have collected, that people have collected, it looks like it's a real strong potential for carbon sequestration with the way we ranch and the way we farm. So what industries are using or needing carbon sequestration and actually spending lots of money on it, and that's the oil industry. And in Canada, there's a project called Quest where the Alberta government and an oil company are putting $1.3 billion into a carbon capture and sequestration project. They're going to have to capture the carbon, stick it underground, and hope it stays there. And so what I'm proposing to that oil company is, what if you spent that same amount of money and educated ranchers to change the way they're ranching? How much more carbon could you possibly get? And then you're actually getting what you need, which is the carbon capture and sequestration, but you're actually getting it in a natural way that creates where you could be a hero. Mm-hmm. And that's the conversation that I'm in right now. And it's getting people's attention. It's very interesting. I don't see how we're going to stop using oil in the next few days, right? And I think that we have too much carbon in the atmosphere already right now. Mm-hmm. So we have to figure out a way to suck it down. It's looking like this land use piece has a lot of potential. And so my next film is going to be on this. It's a short film, be done by the end of the year, I hope. And I think that the way we're using our land could be a huge, huge solution to how much carbon's up in the atmosphere. And then you get all the benefits.
Let's go back to this idea that we're already paying a carbon tax, because people, when the idea of a carbon tax comes up, people get up in arms and
go crazy.
Well, they go crazy about it. They don't want to do it. It's unfair, blah, blah, blah. We're already paying the carbon tax, you say. So give us it's hidden. Talk about that some more.
Well, so there's a study done by the Harvard School of Public Health and a bunch of other groups, and they decided, how much does it cost to use coal in the United States right now? What are those external costs that aren't on the extraction company's bills, aren't on the utility company's bills, and aren't on me, the customer's bills? And so, like I was saying before, when you take away nature's ecosystem services, in Kentucky we have more miles of rolling, of flowing water than any other state. And we've lost 2,000 miles of flowing water in creeks and rivers from mountaintop removal. Mm-hmm. We've lost that. That flowing of water through mountains purifies water. And so now that water is not being able to flow through mountains, it's not as clean. So when it gets down to Lexington, they have to actually have more time on their water treatment plant turned on to clean up that water. So that's an expense. When you have big trucks rolling on state roads, whether it's for – we're talking about coal, but I know this works with fracking as well. Those roads just get beat up. I mean, it's just physics. Mm-hmm. And that's a tax on the people in the state that they have to pay to get those roads fixed. But that's not on the folks who are using the roads. They don't pay nearly what it takes to fix those roads. So that's an actual fee that we in Kentucky and folks in Arkansas and other states are having to pay. So that's a cost. And then when you look at the emissions from the coal-burning plants, that actually affects people's health. And there's numbers that people use of how many people die from that and how much is that person's life worth, and they factor all that in. So when you add all those things up, that's where you get to a third of $1 trillion for how much we're using, you know, that external cost for using coal in the United States today. And that's about 17 cents a kilowatt hour.
Wow.
So it's not that it's not happening. It's that people don't know it. And so you letting me say this on your radio show is part of that solution. So the people just become aware. Wow, there is a cost to this that I didn't know about. So, okay, so people say, well, then a solar panel, what's the life cycle assessment of building that solar panel, the energy it takes to mine the materials for the solar panel, all that stuff? Great, let's figure that out. How much does it cost to build that wind turbine? How much does it cost to put the truck out there to build and put the wind turbine up? Let's figure that out. What's the life cycle assessment of natural gas? What's the life cycle assessment of nuclear energy? Let's just figure all that out so that we know exactly what that electron costs. So then you can make very educated decisions.
You were on Science Friday with Ira Flatow.
Yep.
And you told him, we're toast or very close to being toast.
I said we've got too much CO2 up there already, yet I know that I'm seeing solutions that will be very powerful. And it's really the land use piece that's the one that's got my attention right now.
Do you agree that we're toast or very close to being toast? Terry?
I don't. I really do believe in adaptation, and I do think that we will not have life as we have it today, and things will change, and we will adapt. However, the health component for me with putting so much into the air, land, and water, you know, that is my primary concern, that creates a very unhealthy living environment, and you can't adapt to that.
Well, we have one email I'm going to read on the air very quickly. Beth and Charlotte, your guest questioned why the politicians in Washington, actually I questioned it, haven't gotten on board with these carbon and energy concerns. The answer is simple. The Koch brothers, who have contributed millions to discredit global warming and have effectively turned the tide in Washington against energy efficiency, clean energy. There is no mystery here. Is that true, you think? Very quickly, 5 seconds.
I don't know the answer to that question.
I threw you a curve. You can't answer it in the time allotted. Yeah. Peter Bick, Carbon Nation, Terry Bennett, doyourpart.com. Thanks for being with us.